It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Don't speak, bitch. Come on now.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 883. Of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, October 13th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. First and foremost, I hope everybody caught in the path of Hurricane Milton made it out okay. It looks like you guys avoided the worst of what they were predicting, but that doesn't mean that it didn't wreak havoc or damage your home or that people weren't killed. You know, you've got all that water, you've got flying debris, you've got down power lines, you've got live wires. I mean, it's a dangerous situation. I saw the winds were so strong it even ripped the roof on Tropicana Field to shreds. I was there for the Royal Rumble this year. Tropicana Field was home to the Thunderdome when WWE was doing those pandemic shows. That roof was only intended to withstand wind speeds, they said, of up to 115 miles an hour. And those winds were a hell of a lot more than 115 miles an hour when they hit. Ric Flair was so broken up by what was happening in his hometown of Tampa. He tweeted, "I am so sorry for being in Las Vegas, reaping the benefits of being the personality that I am." Who says that? Like, how do you even write that sentence and think that it's a great idea before hitting send? He said he can't give $100,000 for the relief efforts because they have to go to his ex-wives, but he said he can spare $1,000, which is fine. Every little bit helps, but he just had to promote his woo energy. He offered to send cases of woo energy to whoever wanted it. Guarantee you those things aren't selling as well as he hoped, and he's looking to unload as many of them as possible. He's trying to get... It's like when WWE had all the IcoPro back in the 90s. Guarantee you they still got IcoPro stashed away in some warehouse in Connecticut somewhere. They couldn't unload that shit fast enough. But I just can't get over that. Like, I'm sorry to be in Las Vegas reaping the benefits of being me. Like, how tone deaf do you have to be? I mean, I know we're talking about Flair here. It's not the only dumb thing he's ever said. But I mean, are you serious? I also want to take a moment to send my condolences to the friends and family of Charles Perez, better known as Juan Jeremy, who was a staple at the World of Unpredictable Wrestling. Trained by Johnny Rods out of Gleason's gym and working with Johnny for many years, training other wrestlers and working on the digital side of things for Johnny as well. He was in Japan this past week wrestling for a Kaiju Big Battle when he died unexpectedly. This would have been Thursday night Japan time, not long after the show. He seemed fine after his match. He was even out mingling with the fans during intermission. And a friend of mine who was very close with him was also on that tour. And that trip went from being one of the best of his life to one of the worst in a heartbeat. It's just awful. Nearly 25 years in the business, whether you knew him as the Cornerman or as Dusto Bunny from Kaiju Big Battle or Juan Jeremy or simply as Charles. There's a lot of people hurting right now. Most of all, his family, who are in the process of trying to fly him back to the U.S. and pay not only for his journey home, but for two funeral services, one here and one overseas. So if you would like to help out, the family has a GoFundMe set up to assist with any and all expenses. I posted a link to it on my Twitter page a few days ago, but you can just go directly to the GoFundMe website and search for Juan Jeremy. It should be the first campaign that pops up. So again, my condolences to his friends and family. You could tell how much somebody means to people when you see the outpouring of love that there has been this week for him, and they should all take some solace in that. Today, we're going to talk about Wrestle Dream. I did not go live last night, so you're getting the full review today, and I have an update on The Rock and his WrestleMania status, since there's been a lot of talk about that this last couple of days. Thanks to one Dave Meltzer. If you would like to make a PayPal donation, you can always do so on thesolomonster.com. I want to say thank you to PB. Holy shit. Thank you very much for the birthday love this past week. My God, I don't know what else to say other than thank you. Big B, Brian Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, the Cape Cod Crusader, Chris Setterland, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Killshot, Keith Hart, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Sweet Sapphire, Sarah Kittleson, thank you for the birthday card. The Christmas stamp was fine with me. It was very festive. I have some here myself. And Show Your Roll, Chris Ludeck. Check out his YouTube series. You've heard me mention this before. What Could Have Been in Wrestling. Just search for Chris Ludeck. You can spell that, the word deck, with an E on the end of it. So it's L-U-D-E-C-K-E is his name. But type in What Could Have Been in Wrestling, and you could check out the series for yourself. He's got some good content up there. I also want to mention House of Glory is back this Friday. We already have our next show, Salvation, at the NYC Arena in Queens. We have the TNA World Heavyweight Champion, Nick Nemeth, making his debut. And for the first time ever, he's going to be taking on the returning El Hijo del Vikingo. We have not had Vikingo in House of Glory in quite some time, and he actually just made his return not that long ago from injury, so this is a first-time-ever match that you're getting. Plus, Mike Santana defends the HOG World Championship against ECW and Japanese wrestling legend Masato Tanaka. Zilla Fatu defends the Crown Jewel Championship, the only Crown Jewel title that matters, the OG Crown Jewel title. And Ally Catch makes her HOG debut as well. So the show kicks off at 8 p.m., streams live on Triller TV Plus. Tickets are still available at hogwrestling.net. If you come to the show, do stop by and say hello. By the way, our Believe in the Glory show from the end of last month with Joe Hendry is now up on Triller. It went up this past week a little bit late because we didn't stream live this time. There was a medical emergency, and so we didn't have the usual crew that we have to set up shop and stream live, but we did record the show. It is up now on Triller. This show this Friday will be airing live, as it usually does, barring any unforeseen circumstances. The National League Championship Series kicks off tonight with the Mets against the Dodgers. This is their first trip to the Championship Series in 9 years. The last time the Mets played in the NLCS, Brock Lesnar beat The Undertaker in a Hell in a Cell match. That's how long it's been. There is not a single match, by the way, on that pay-per-view where both people in the same match still work for that company. That's how long it's been. This team has been on a special run that I was not expecting, and it's been a lot of fun to watch them scratch and claw and fight their way to wins. I mean, you could be down 3 runs in the 8th inning, and you just expect them to come back. And there's no guarantees of anything. The Dodgers are a tough team, but the Mets can win this, and they can go to the World Series. And on the other side, you've got the Yankees and you've got the Guardians. Maybe we get 2 New York teams back in the World Series this year. It's very possible. But I bring this up because I was watching the Yankee game on TBS the other night. TBS or TNT, I forget which. I think it was TBS. And they had Bob Costas doing the play-by-play. And I had not had the chance to listen to Bob Costas in any of these games, but the reaction to his commentary on social media this postseason has been horrible. I mean, you would think that Kevin Patrick was back doing play-by-play on Monday Night Raw. Low energy, no enthusiasm, right? I've seen all the criticism. So finally, I'm watching one of the games, and he is as dreadful as everybody has been saying. Those TBS broadcasts are just fucking awful. Even the camera angles they use, like they have that wide shot where the pitcher and the batter are like far left of the screen. Like my OCD was just driving me nuts. And I assume it's because they want to get the sponsor in the shot on the right. But I just think as a viewer, it just looks horrendous. But anyway, so I'm watching the game and I tweeted about that time that Christian came back to WWE in 2009. Remember, they put him on the ECW brand. He was supposed to come back at the Royal Rumble that year as Jeff Hardy's mystery attacker and cost him the title. But they called an audible and they went with Matt Hardy instead, turning on his brother, because they figure, well, you know, the word was out. Everybody was expecting Christian. Vince McMahon thought it would be too predictable. Even during the match between Jeff and Edge, if you watch that Rumble show, you could hear fans chanting, "We want Christian. We want Christian." So he probably would have been cheered had he shown up, which is not the response that they were looking for. So he ends up going to ECW instead. And that is when we got Todd Grisham's infamous call of, it's Christian. Like, in the most unenthusiastic, just monotone, driest possible manner. And in the tweet, I said, remember that? Well, that Grisham call was still more enthusiastic than Bob Costas calling postseason baseball games. Well, Grisham saw the tweet. And he quote tweeted me with a response. Now, I was not expecting my Bob Costas tweet to make news, but indeed it did. And now we know why Todd Grisham said it the way that he did. I think we could have guessed right off the way that the Irish madman used to micromanage all the announcers. But I don't think he's ever told the story before. If he has, maybe it was on some obscure podcast that there's really not a lot of talk about it. But Grisham said right before he walked out of the gorilla position before the show that night, Vince McMahon called him over and said, in no uncertain terms, when Christian walks out, don't get excited at all. Just simply say, it's Christian, and that's it. Do you understand me? And what is the guy supposed to say? It's his boss. Of course, he said, yes, sir. And that's why we got what we got. So it's nice to know that from the moment Christian came back to the company, Vince McMahon was trying to sabotage him. First, he took a much bigger spot away from him at the Royal Rumble, and then he warned the announcer to basically no-sell his return, like his fucking waiter brought out the wrong order. So then Tony Khan sees this tweet from Todd Grisham. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and he replies, this is insane. And then Tony tweets, Christian Cage is the man. And Christian was trending on Twitter for the next 48 hours. Now, I cannot help but feel responsible for this, but you know what? It may not have been my intent, but I'm glad that it trended. Because Christian is the man. He's done some of the best work of his career in these last few years. And I find it kind of poetic that Vince McMahon once wanted to superimpose a blue dot over Christian's face on TV because he didn't like the way his face looked. Alex Greenfield told the story. He was a writer for the company at the time. This was many years ago. And they were on a flight to the UK. And Christian was starting to get really popular at the time. And on the plane, Vince is sitting there and he just turns and he goes, you know, his face really bothers me. And they're like, you think he's ugly? And he goes, no, he's not ugly. He just has a ratty looking face. He's got like a rat face. We should do the Kennedy gimmick. And nobody knew what the fuck he was talking about. Like, what Kennedy gimmick? Like, what Kennedy gimmick? You want him to get shot in the head? Like, what are you talking about? But no, in the 90s, there was a member of the Kennedy family who was charged with rape. And when his accuser took the stand during his trial, all the television networks, they put a blue dot over her face to shield her identity. That's what he wanted to do with Christian, because he thought he had a rat face. So it's poetic that Vince is the one more likely these days to have a blue dot over his face than Christian if they ever show him on TV again. Wrestle Dream. Let's talk about Wrestle Dream. The show ended so late I started dreaming before it was over. I didn't go live last night, so this is going to be my review. If you were a babyface, especially a babyface in a title match, Saturday night was not a good night for you. If you were a heel in a championship match, break out the bubbly, because it was a good night to be bad. Jon Moxley is your new AEW World Heavyweight Champion for the fourth time. Jack Perry, still your TNT champion. The Young Bucks, still your AEW World Tag Team Champions, even though, according to Fightful, there were people behind the scenes who were pushing for Private Party to win that match, but it was not meant to be. Mariah May, still your AEW Women's World Champion. And Konosuke Takeshita, your AEW International Champion. It was a very heel-heavy night. Now, whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, is subjective. The biggest surprise of the night for me was no blood, especially after that main event that we got it all out last month. Outside of some very minor blood over Bryan Danielson's eyebrow, and Jeff Jarrett got a cut on his face, like on his cheek, in the post-match angle, I believe the rules in the state of Washington dictate no bleeding. Not allowed to bleed. So it was one of those rare months where we had more blood on the WWE pay-per-view than we did on the AEW one. It was actually nice for a change. We also had two surprise returns in MJF and Adam Cole. MJF has been out filming a movie. Cole has been out trying to get cleared, which he has now been medically cleared, after hurting himself more than a year ago. Adam Cole was revealed as the devil last year. He betrayed MJF after MJF lost the AEW World Championship to Samoa Joe. When MJF first came back at Double or Nothing, he dropped Adam Cole on his head, and he told the referees to get that piece of shit out of his ring. And he was wildly cheered for doing so, because he was the face and Cole was the heel. And we had not seen Adam Cole since. And yet last night, there he was, every bit as wildly popular as MJF was when he first came back, only now it was Adam Cole chasing MJF out of the ring. The roles have been reversed. The shoe is now on the other foot. And it's actually not that hard to try to explain why Cole would be coming for MJF. I'm going to tell you why when I get to that part. But getting Cole and MJF back is big for Tony Khan because it gives him two big names back that he has not been able to use. Now, there was no Shane McMahon on this show, though a lot of people were expecting a Shane McMahon appearance here. It's fine with me. I didn't want him there to begin with. But I was surprised that we did not see him at the very end. Instead, they shot a major injury angle with Bryan Danielson, who, after losing the AEW World Championship to Jon Moxley, thus ending his full-time career, was stretchered out of the arena. Tony Schiavone even filled in for Tony Khan in the post-show scrum because we were told Tony Khan went to the hospital with Bryan Danielson. And yet Darby Allin and other babyfaces, Orange Cassidy and Hook and Daniel Garcia, they all came out to the ring to try to fend off the heels, and they were foiled one by one. We even had Excalibur doing some horrible fake crying. Anytime Excalibur has to act, it's a bad night. He was doing this horrible fake crying. It almost killed the entire angle for me. If the goal was to get me to laugh, congratulations, because I was this close from losing my shit. God, was that terrible. The angle itself, I thought, was actually well done. And I assume Shane is still coming, but they're going to hold off until Full Gear, or maybe even World's End, like they did with the Devil reveal last year. I only hope this angle goes better for them than that one did. Now, as far as match quality goes, AEW, they always deliver great matches on these shows. This one was no exception. Moxley and Danielson, they had a really good main event with a really flat finish. Will Ospreay, Ricochet, Konosuke, Takeshita, they stole the show. Nobody could touch them after that. Match of the night. Mariah May and Willow Nightingale, they had a really good women's title match. Hangman Page and Jay White, they opened the show with a banger of a match. So in-ring, it was excellent. But some of the other matches I just didn't care about. Some of them felt slapped together at the last minute, and I just couldn't get into them. And when you have 5 straight hours of wrestling, if you include the pre-show, we're talking 5 hours of wrestling. It started at 7, they went off the air at midnight on the dot. After a while, this shit just starts to all run together. That's the drawback of doing really long shows like this. So it was not my favorite AEW show of the year. All In, for example, I enjoyed that more. I mean, that 1-2 punch of Danielson against Swerve and Ospreay against MJF just can't be beat. And then you throw in Tony Storm against Mariah May. But on the whole, I thought that this was a strong show. One with multiple stories coming out of it, including the BCC story. Kyle Fletcher turning on Will Ospreay. Adam Cole coming after MJF. Daniel Garcia now gunning for Jack Perry in the TNT title. And Swerve Strickland rejecting MVP services, which you know is going to lead to the debut of Bobby Lashley and a new program for Swerve. Those stories, not the matches, those stories are what are going to make Dynamite sink or swim in the coming weeks and how interesting they make those stories. But you can't say they don't have any coming out of last night's show. They have multiple ones. They had four matches on the 0 hour pre-show. Brian Cage beat Atlantis Jr. to win the Ring of Honor television title. I do not care about the Ring of Honor television title, but good for Cage. I didn't have him figured for a win here. Anna Jay, coming off her stint in Stardom, picked up a win over Harley Cameron. Solid effort. You can see the improvement that Anna has made. But at the finish, Anna covered Harley, and Harley's shoulder was up off the mat. So the referee, literally right in front of the camera, I mean, he didn't know that, but the referee literally helped push her shoulder down so that he could count 1, 2, 3. It's where the best wrestle, you see. Yeah, that was a little embarrassing. The Acclaim got a win over MXM Collection, Mason and Mansoor, who had Rico in their corner. They dusted off Rico Constantino, doing his old Rico gimmick from WWE when he was with Billy and Chuck, dressed the same way. So it was amusing to see Rico and Billy Gunn back on TV together, although on opposing sides this time. Rico looks a little bit older. I mean, it's been 20 years. But even though he looks a little bit older, I think on the whole, he doesn't really look all that different. You know, he still mostly looks the same. They worked a spot where Rico ended up in the ring with Billy and tried a spin kick that Billy caught. And then Billy told him to suck his dick and hit him with a Famouser. Rico did not, in fact, suck his dick, but he did take a bump off the Famouser. Anthony Bowens hit the arrival on Mansoor, and then Max Caster hit the mic drop for the win. I enjoyed the Rico cameo. It was good to see him. Tony Schiavone was on stage to introduce Tony Khan and Antonio Inoki's grandsons, Hirota and Naoto. You know, Wrestle Dream was conceived last year as a tribute to Inoki. You know, Tony has called him wrestling's greatest dreamer. Tommy Dreamer is fuming right now. So the sentiment here I thought was nice. It was a nice sentiment from Tony Khan, but this segment was a disaster because the idea was that Tony would reference Inoki's classic chant and they would throw the chant up on the screen so everybody else could see it and they would all do the chant. So Tony mentions Inoki's chant and at first nobody in the crowd responds when he first mentions it because of course they have no fucking idea what it is. So then Tony, he looks up at the screens like he's waiting for something. But there's nothing. Finally, they flash the chant on the big screen. It's Ichi Ni San Da. Ichi Ni San Da. And they have it up on the screen. And Tony calls for it one more time. Let's do it one more time. And nothing. Looks up at the screens. They're waiting for them to flash the chant again. It takes like 10 seconds before they finally throw it up on the screens. I winced through this entire thing. He meant well. I could appreciate that Tony Khan is a savant of wrestling history here, and obviously he's got a lot of love for Antonio Inoki, but yeah, this was not good. And the big party match on the pre-show, as they try to get as many people on the show as humanly possible, had the Outrunners, Orange Cassidy, and Kyle O'Reilly against John Silver, Alex Reynolds, Tony Nese, and Arya Daivari. You remember how over the Outrunners were in that tag team gauntlet match in their hometown? Well, it's not just their hometown. They're really over with these fans right now. And they even got the win here. So the good guys win. The Outrunners pick up the victory for their team. The Outrunners, you know, they're a fun act. And they are getting over. And if I were Tony Khan, what I would do, especially since, you know, the Bucks held on to the belts last night and they didn't do a title change, I would build a story around the Outrunners eventually being the ones to beat the Bucks and win the tag team titles. I think it would be a great story. It's not a hard story to tell. I know they kind of come off as almost like a comedy gimmick. They're literally, I mean, something straight out of the 80s, even the vignettes, which I think are well done. Everything is meant to look very, you know, dated and classic and retro. I love it. You know, I dig that kind of stuff. But they're getting over. They're a team that make people happy. They make them smile. They make them laugh. They're into these guys. And hopefully they can keep that going. And you could easily tell a story where the Bucks aren't even taking these guys seriously, but they continue to win. They rack up wins. We see them more often on Dynamite, which we haven't, but I'm saying we should. And then eventually have them be the ones to take those titles. I also love that the Outrunners, they come out to The Man Who Made a Monster, which is a song by Dance with the Dead. I've had that on my Spotify playlist for years. It's a dark synthwave. I fucking love dark synthwave. I mean, I like synthwave in general, but love it. Midnight Danger is another one. I love their music. So the main card opened with Hangman Adam Page one-on-one with Switchblade Jay White. Jay White missed a few months with a foot injury. He also lost to Hangman in the Owen Hart Foundation tournament. That was his last match before he came back recently. So he was looking for a measure of revenge and also looking to get back on track so that he could challenge again for the AEW World Championship, which was music to my ears when he said that the other week, because I was worried when he comes back, they're just going to slot him right back into that trios garbage. He's better than that. But this was also a match where neither man could really lose, right? I wouldn't have beaten either one of these guys. I mean, I said it the other week. If it were up to me, I wouldn't even beat Hangman Page until he wins back the world championship. Because I'd put that title on him. Then eventually Swerve can win the belt back. When he does, he wins it back from Hangman, right? You put some distance between them for a while. You don't go right back to it again. But that would be long-term storytelling with those two. So I wouldn't have beaten Hangman, but yeah, Jay White just came back. Ideally, you don't want to beat him in his first big match back either. But that's what they did here. They beat Hangman, and they gave Jay White the win. And I can't hate on this. They had a great match. It was a great opener. And the finish was great, too. White was taking shots all night long in this match at Hangman's leg, including a knee breaker on the edge of the ramp. And when Hangman eventually tried for the Buckshot Lariat, he couldn't really pull it off because of the leg. So then he went for it again, and this time when he vaulted himself into the ring, he flew right into the waiting arms of Jay White, who dropped him with the Blade Runner, and he pinned him. And that got a great reaction. It didn't take much to get the fans to cheer for Jay White, and they did the finish in such a way that protected Hangman because of the injury. These are the two guys right here. I shouldn't say the two guys. These are two guys that Tony Khan should be building his company around. And not the only two. They've got Will Ospreay. They've got MJF. They've got Swerve. A lot of talent in this company. But these two need to be in that group. Mariah May and Willow Nightingale for the AEW Women's World Championship was even better than their final in the Owen Hart tournament back in July. To set this up, Willow lost to Chris Statlander at All Out. The same Chris Statlander who is now a babyface again for her feud with Mercedes. So why is Statlander getting a shot at the TBS title? And Willow, who lost to her, is getting a shot at the women's world title. Maybe Britt Baker was supposed to beat Willow on Dynamite and she was supposed to be in this match. I don't think so. I didn't think they would beat Britt at Wembley and then just beat her again, like put her into another title match for the other belt and beat her there again. But at least if she was supposed to get the shot, and she did, she got sick. She missed the show on Wednesday with strep throat. And they had to call an audible and make Willow the number one contender. At least that would make some sense. But I don't know if that's the case or not. Mariah May is a terrific heel. If you didn't know that already, I mean, this woman slapped the shit out of her own mother at Wembley Stadium. And then, of course, that great angle where she turned on Toni Storm, one of the great segments all year on Dynamite. So Mariah May is a great heel. And Willow is an even better babyface. So they had the crowd loud, especially for the final few minutes they did. Mariah connected on Mayday. Willow kicked out, which left Mariah shocked. And Willow avoided Storm Zero, tried to pounce. Mariah fired off a headbutt, but before Willow went down, she swung for the fences and blasted her with a lariat into the double down. Mariah floated over a doctor bomb, but Willow hit a running Death Valley driver into the turnbuckles. Then on the ropes, Mariah tried for a Rana attempt, but Willow muscled her up into a powerbomb position, which Mariah then turned into a Hurricane Rana, and she took Willow off the top all the way to the mat. The fans are on their feet for this. Mariah lands a charging knee strike and then immediately hits Storm Zero and pins her to retain the title. This was very good, and it just doesn't seem to matter how many times Willow loses. She's still super over. And Mariah needed a match like this, I think, to really solidify her title reign, which has been pretty lackluster. I mean, let's be honest. And not because of her work or anything like that, but it's just been a very paint-by-numbers, lackluster run these last couple of months. And so she got the match that she needed here. This was the best defense of her run so far, easily. The post-show press scrum, I have to mention this, because I watched the post-show press scrum. I mentioned Tony Khan was not there. They had Tony Schiavone filling in. It was depressing. They trotted Mariah May out there, and they asked if anybody had any questions, if any of the reporters in the room had any questions. And at first, nobody raised their hand. Like, they're looking around. You can see them scanning the room. They're hoping, they're praying that somebody's going to put their hand up. They're like, don't be shy now. So finally, one guy put his hand up from bodyslam.net, and he asked the question, but that was it. You know, Tony Schiavone threw it back for more questions, and they just sat there waiting. And finally, she stormed off. You mean to tell me that there is not one person in that fucking room who could raise their hand and ask a kayfabe question about her thoughts on Mercedes as the TBS champion and try to get some snarky comment from her about Mercedes, right? Maybe a future match with her, or ask about her friendship with Mina, or ask about Jamie Hayter. What do you think about Jamie being back, and would you like to defend your title against her? Because that's the match that I'm waiting for. You know, I got people out here on social media talking about a rematch with Tony Storm. Oh, they must be waiting, and they're going to do a rematch with Tony. So they're just sort of delaying the inevitable. They don't have anything for Mariah to do, which, by the way, don't be that person. That's bullshit. That's making excuses for them. But you got people out here talking about a rematch with Tony Storm. There's nothing to be gained from that. They told their story already. What they need to do is build to Jamie Hayter challenging Mariah May and getting her belt back that she was effectively screwed out of. Not that I can blame these people too much for not asking about Jamie Hayter. I mean, what the hell have they done with her since she came back? But I was sitting here, I'm suffering secondhand embarrassment watching that press scrum, and they're just sitting there. And nobody could think of anything to ask this woman? Are they too busy taking selfies? Like, why are they even there? Why even go to a press scrum if you're not going to ask questions? Jack Perry against Katsuyori Shibata for the TNT Championship. This is one of those matches that just came out of nowhere with no real build. Perry is hated enough that he got good heat. The finish did not go over well with the crowd at all. Shibata sank in a rear naked choke, only for Perry to bridge up, and the referee counted Shibata's shoulders down for the three count. And the boos rained down. Now, they did it as a way to protect Shibata. I don't know why Shibata needs protecting. What are they protecting him for? But Perry is a sneaky little shit, so I guess it kind of fits his MO. Perry attacked him with a belt shot after the match. He was going to go for another one when Daniel Garcia sprinted to the ring, and he got up in Perry's face. And Perry shook his head no, and he bailed. And all of a sudden, they played MJF's music, and out walked Happy Gilmore's son. He's back. He power walked to the ring. He went face to face with Garcia until Jack Perry blasted Garcia in the back of the head with the TNT title, and then he left. MJF took his jacket off. He took the microphone. He brought up the so-called bidding war for Garcia, which he said was about as real as the Seattle Supersonics. Instant heat for that here in Tacoma. It wasn't Elias heat from that one Raw segment years ago, but boy, these people, they do not like it when you bring up the Supersonics. So it's easy heat. I'd love to know more about this bidding war, though. What war was there for the services of Daniel Garcia? I mean, yeah, come on, he's a good wrestler, but let's not get carried away now. So he also thanked Garcia for mentioning that he pawned the Dynamite Diamond ring at a pawn shop in Buffalo because it took him some time, but he tracked it down and he got it. He found it and he pulled out the ring. So I guess Tony Khan had time to have another one made, maybe with some of that Warner Brothers Discovery money. He told Garcia he was going to kiss it and he placed the ring on his finger. But before he could use it, Adam Cole's music hits, and he got a huge babyface reaction, even though the last time we saw him, he was a heel. Fans are very forgiving. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. So he and MJF have now flipped roles, and the Undisputed Kingdom was but a very bad dream. One of the greatest fails in AEW history. If I were them, I would pretend that it never happened too. Because as soon as they both got hurt, it killed the entire angle. They should have dropped it right then and there. And Cole, he actually ran to the ring. And MJF bailed into the crowd. Cole helped Garcia to his feet, and they each paid respect to each other with a fist bump. The match was a complete afterthought. It only existed to set up the Garcia save and the two returns that came after. Nobody is talking about Jack Perry against Katsuyori Shibata. They're talking about everything that happened after the match. Now, whatever you think of Adam Cole gets a lot of shit from a lot of people. Oh, he's too small. Oh, he's so skinny. Look at this. My sister is bigger than Adam Cole. You know what? You may be right. I've seen your sister. She is bigger than Adam Cole. But these fans here in the building, they treated his return like a big deal. In their eyes, he's a major star. They like him, and they're happy to have him back. And so getting two big names back, like Cole and MJF, can only help the show. So they set up Cole against MJF as one direction, and they set up Perry against Garcia as another direction. So these are two future programs now that are coming up very soon. I think that Daniel Garcia is the one to take that title from Jack Perry, because they did re-sign him. They did throw, I'm sure, some good money at him. And they do look at him as somebody that they want to build around. You know, Daniel Garcia has been in AEW now for a number of years. We used to call him Main Event Garcia because he was having main event matches almost every week on TV against the big names in the company. You saw him in there with people like Moxley and Danielson. I think he may have wrestled Kenny Omega and a bunch of different people. So if that's how they view him and they think that there is something there and they want to build him up, then he should be the one now that he's this big babyface who's all elite now. He should be the one to take that title from Jack Perry, if Tony Khan is serious about pushing him. Now, as far as Cole and MJF, why would Cole target MJF? Well, besides the fact that the last time we saw him, he took a brainbuster from him, got dumped on his head, just look back at that first promo on TV at the beginning of this year. This was after World's End. This was after he stabbed MJF in the back. He called MJF a narcissist. A narcissist who ran his mouth for years about how much better he was than everybody else. And he stabbed MJF in the back before he had the chance to do the same to him. He did everything for MJF. He even broke his ankle for him. He blamed MJF for what happened to his leg. And it's true. I mean, when he came out at Grand Slam last year, they had that ramp, and that's how he got hurt. He ran down the ramp. He jumped off, and he broke his fucking ankle. And he did it to come down to rally MJF during his match with Samoa Joe. He holds him responsible for what happened. He lost more than a year of his career because of that. That's enough of an explanation for me. In a company where they don't always take time to explain things, things just sort of happen. It's like the Joker in The Dark Knight, right? Do I look like a man with a plan? Somebody should put the Joker makeup on Tony Khan. Do I look like a man with a plan? I just do things, right? In a company where we see a lot of that, this explanation is good enough for me. And I suspect that we'll hear that from Adam Cole maybe this Wednesday when he cuts his first promo. But that's where I think they're going with it. So they had a course correct because the original angle was a flop. There was no saving it, especially not after the choice they made to turn MJF heel again. I don't know when we get the match. I don't even know, you know, that Cole is going to be wrestling right away, even though he is said to be medically cleared. They may be holding off a little bit longer. World's End would, you know, make sense because it's the anniversary of the Devil reveal. So if you wanted to do the match on that show, that would certainly make sense. Then we had the match that I wanted to see. For the international title, Will Ospreay defending against Ricochet and Konosuke Takeshita. How we got here? Suspect. Suspect at best, given that they were teasing a match with Takeshita and Okada for the Continental title, and then they pivoted to this. As a match, you knew it would steal the show. Any Will Ospreay match is likely going to steal the show on any given night, but you throw in Ricochet and you throw in Konosuke Takeshita, and you've got a match of the year candidate, which is what these three had. Don Callis joined on commentary at ringside. Takeshita set up a table at ringside that would come into play later in the match. And there was a wild sequence where Takeshita wiped out Ospreay with a crunchy into a deadlift German. Ricochet then flew in with a handspring, but Takeshita countered into a Blue Thunder Bomb for two. Takeshita then destroyed these men with a pair of forearm shots. He threw a lariat so hard that Ospreay flipped over onto his feet and then dropped him with an Os Cutter. But before Ospreay could even get up or go for the pin or anything, Ricochet comes flying in from off screen with a springboard 450 splash. And then we had some Poison Rana no sells, which I could do without, from Ospreay and Ricochet. I hate that. Takeshita looked down at the table outside, and he delivered a crunchy to Ricochet down through the table. And then back inside, Ospreay met Takeshita climbing back in with a hidden blade, but he kicked out at one. So Ospreay hit it again, but this time Don Callis pulled the referee out of the ring. And then Callis got into the ring. He went for a screwdriver shot. Ospreay blocked it, and he got Callis set up for a tiger driver until Kyle Fletcher, dressed in a hoodie to conceal his identity, except that we could all tell who it was. He hit the ring, and he hit Ospreay in the back of the head with a screwdriver shot. Kyle Fletcher turns on his best friend. And Takeshita dropped his knee pad. He hit the power drive knee. And he covered Ospreay to win the international title. So they protected Ricochet by not having him take the losing fall. And they protected Ospreay in so much as, obviously, he got attacked with a fucking screwdriver. So he's got that as a built-in excuse. But Takeshita now holds gold for the first time here in AEW. After the match, Fletcher picked up Ospreay. He hit a Tiger Driver 91 or 93 or 97. Who gives a shit? He dropped him on his fucking head. It seemed obvious Fletcher was going to be turning, especially the other week when he and Callis, they had to leave early, right? Leave early to go catch a flight. That was the night that Takeshita attacked Ospreay and Ricochet during their match. This was an outstanding match. This was spectacular. It's about damn time they put gold around Takeshita's waist. He's too good not to be a champion. And if they're not going to do anything with him and Okada right now, then the international title is a great fit for him. This is something I would have done a long time ago. I would still love to see Takeshita go to the finals of the Continental Classic. I said this last week, beat Okada there. They could always get back to it. But they obviously decided they didn't want to turn him right now. They want to keep him as a heel. If you did that, he would very likely end up being a babyface. But this was easily the best Ricochet match of his run so far in AEW. Ospreay, you know, look, I don't mind them taking the title from him because they need to start building him for a world championship run next year. So that's fine with me. We know that's where he's headed. Texas, all in next year. That should be his crowning moment. He doesn't need the international title right now. He's not harmed by losing the international title. They advertised an appearance by Swerve Strickland here in his hometown. And it was smart, I thought, to put this here because there was no match that could follow what we just saw. And we have not seen Swerve since All Out. Prince Nana introduced him out to the ring, but not before plugging his coffee. He plugged his Prince Nana coffee. You know, when Swerve and Nana, they came back to House of Glory in July, I got handed something about, it was like a flyer, about Prince Nana's coffee. And this guy, he was hanging around. He had to be his business partner. And I didn't even know if it was real. It seemed like a parody or something. But then I realized, no, it's actually very real. And I'll tell you what, if I actually drank coffee, I might try it. But I think coffee is disgusting, so I'm not going to. But I'm sure Prince Nana's coffee tastes like strawberries and rainbows. I'm sure it's delicious. Swerve said that it feels weird to be out there with the AEW title not around his waist, but he's happy to be home again. He announced that he is medically cleared, and he was about to address his future when he was interrupted by MVP and Shelton Benjamin. And MVP said that it's his future that he wanted to come out here to discuss. Maybe Nana didn't give him MVP's business card. He said Swerve's career is floundering a little bit right now. Thankfully, MVP is good at taking former champions and reminding them why they're great. So he said, let's talk business. Swerve then put over MVP. He put over Shelton Benjamin. But he also said that MVP wasn't wrong about the things that he said about Prince Nana. And this made Nana very nervous. Swerve said, you know, I lost my title and my childhood home under your watch. He said that, on the other hand, I wouldn't have had all those things if it wasn't for Prince Nana. But man, the potential with me and MVP and Shelton, I mean, we can make history together. So Swerve told Nana there are things about him that irk him sometimes. Said Nana is, for one, he's still selling weed to high school kids out in parking lots. That sounds like a matter for Tony Khan's disciplinary committee. But the biggest thing about Nana is that he's family. And then he looked at MVP and he said, and I don't turn my back on my family for anybody. He told MVP he could take his business cards and shove them up his ass because he's not interested. And Benjamin told Swerve that you misread the situation. There is no Swerve without us. There is no Swerve without them. And Benjamin said Swerve is either with them or against them. And Nana tried to push Benjamin. Benjamin shoved him. Swerve was about to go after Shelton. MVP got between them. And then on the stage, when they left, MVP looked back and he pointed at his watch while looking at Swerve. This was good stuff. Swerve came off like a total star here. You know, and it helped being in his hometown for him to get that kind of reception. It was a television segment for sure, but they were in Swerve's hometown, so it makes sense to have him on this show. You don't want to leave him off. Them doing this here, though, I thought for sure we were going to get the Bobby Lashley debut. You know, whether he attacked him or he just kind of came out and didn't say anything and just made an appearance to get people talking. You know, we had Adam Copeland last year. He made his debut on the show at the very end. I thought maybe this year it would be Lashley showing up. But I actually like that they didn't do it here. You know, they throw so much shit at us sometimes. Case in point, look at what happened earlier in the show where you had Garcia come out and then MJF came out and then Adam Cole returned. They need to save some stuff for TV. You don't want to throw everything out there in one segment or on one show. You don't want to give everything away like that. So also keep in mind, I don't think that they wanted to kill two hometown guys in one night since they were already doing the angle with Bryan Danielson later to close the show. So to stretch him out and then also leave Swerve laying would have been a buzzkill. But it's clear that the Almighty is on his way in. We had the undefeated Hologram at 14-0 against the Beast Mortos. Best two out of three falls. I don't know why that's funny. Best two out of three falls. No Jake the Snake Roberts out there with Mortos. Uh-oh, maybe the partnership is already over before it's even had a chance to begin. For those who may have missed Dynamite on Tuesday, which was a lot of you, Jake is the new manager for La Facción Ingobernable. He is La Serpiente Mexicana. Yes, it is as ridiculous as it sounds. Give it a few months, it'll be completely forgotten about, as most of Jake's run has been so far. But Jake was not there. It was a lucha spot fest, and the fans really didn't care at first. They did get vocal for the big spots. I just couldn't get into it, especially after that three-way we just saw. It was also two out of three falls, and Mortos pinned Hologram to win the second fall, which is strange because they have an undefeated streak going with Hologram, which they're still acknowledging because he technically won the match, so he's now 15-0. But it was just weird to book him in a match where he would have to be pinned. And also, that was the first time he's ever been pinned, and the crowd did not give a shit. It's not like they reacted big, like, oh my God, Hologram's been pinned. It was almost like, eh, you know what? What do you think? The line at the bathroom, you think it's long, or should I wait a little bit? I don't know. But they also started repeating spots late in the match. Like there was a diving crucifix bomb that they did. I think it was in the first fall. And that was cool. And then they did it again later. Like Hologram did the same move again later. And I'm like, am I watching a replay of the first half of this match? It was almost like they started running out of ideas. Like, okay, the match maybe should not have gone this long. They were out there for like 16 minutes. Hologram won the first fall. Mortos won the second. And then Hologram won the third to win the match. This could have been saved for Dynamite. This could have been saved for Collision. You know, especially with the 2 out of 3 fall stipulation, they could have structured the ad breaks around the end of those falls, you know, to minimize the disruptions in the match. But they just signed a deal with Fox Sports Mexico. They're looking to expand internationally and sign more deals like this. They want to do more lucha matches like this on a regular basis because of that new deal, I guess, to appeal to that audience. And that's fine, but the show was long enough. It did not need this match.
Hey, it's CVV, Chris Van Vliet popping in here for just a second. Obviously, you love wrestling podcasts. I mean, you're listening to one right now. When this episode ends, don't let the fun end there. Go check out my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. All of the interviews that you might have seen clips of on social media or on YouTube, they're all available right here in audio form. Some of my recent interviews include Drew McIntyre, Cody Rhodes, Dave Bautista, Ken Shamrock, Otis, Damian Priest, Bronson Reed. The list goes on and on and on. So go search for Insight with Chris Van Vliet on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this right now.
We had Darby Allin against Brody King. They did not announce this as a street fight, but I guess every Darby Allin match is basically a street fight, and that's kind of what it turned into with the use of the steel steps. Either that or these referees are awfully lenient. This was Darby taking the usual crazy bumps and getting the crap beaten out of him by his larger opponent. King wanted to set up a superplex onto the steel steps that were positioned outside. But Darby fought out of it. He pie-faced Brody off the ropes, and he took this hellacious bump down onto the flat part of the ring steps. That's a big body to take a big bump like that. And then Darby followed with a coffin drop onto Brody on the steps. The referee laid down the count. King barely made it back inside before the 10 count, but he rolled right into a coffin drop, and Darby got the win. They were not going to beat Darby in Tacoma, even though he's from Seattle. But they gave him the hometown welcome, even still. But they weren't going to beat him because Darby needed this win to reset after losing his guaranteed world title shot to Jon Moxley because he's an idiot. After the match, Brody offered Darby a handshake out of respect, which Darby accepted. I don't know what they're doing with Brody King going forward. Almost doesn't even feel like he's part of the House of Black. I mean, I know he is. But maybe get him a singles run. Yeah, again, those guys have been doing the trios thing now for so many years that I think all three of them, frankly, would benefit from, even if they don't break up per se, but you could get so much more out of the House of Black if you get serious about pushing some of them as singles and making them serious contenders to some of those, you know, mid-card championships that you have in this company. The Young Bucks against Private Party for the AEW World Tag Team titles. They aired a hype video for Private Party beforehand showing the Amazing Red, giving them a pep talk, trying to fire them up. The Amazing Red being the one who trained them. And many others. HOG represent, by the way. You better put some fucking respect on that man's name. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough pep in this talk because they still lost. Private Party was not built up very well as believable, credible challengers for the titles. In fact, they were bullied and beaten up by the Blackpool Combat Club only a few weeks ago. But then they picked up a few wins here and there, and so boom, they're the number one contenders. But they had me thinking tonight might just be their night. At the beginning of this match, when the Bucks, they literally were rubbing the belts in their faces and telling them, this is as close as you will ever get to holding these titles. They called them a couple of mid-card failures. I'm thinking, wow, that's kind of harsh. Surely they have to be winning if the Bucks are burying them 6 miles beneath the earth. But nope, they backed up everything they said before the match. It was very quiet at times, but I think that's more a product of how poorly they built this up. Because if the crowd was invested, they would have sounded like it. This is what people don't understand. Why is the crowd so quiet? Because they're not invested. You have a crowd that's invested, or they're super into the challengers, or they think they really have a shot at winning the championships, then they'll be louder. If they're not, then what does that tell you? Now, they did get loud at times with some of the late near falls. Matt Jackson kicked out of a gin and juice, which is Private Party's finish. Zay showed some life late when he avoided an EVP trigger, but he got scooped up into a TK driver and planted for the 3 out of nowhere. And Zay was dejected after the match. He had his head in his hands like he was crying, but they got a respectful reaction from the crowd. Some polite applause. They showed Stokely Hathaway smirking in the crowd because Private Party had rebuffed his recent offer to manage them. So with the loss here and the way they lingered on them when the match was over, maybe they go heel and they link up with Stokely. I don't think they have to go heel, but get that harder edge to them, you know, and maybe they link up with Stokely. And if they link up with Stokely, you know, then like with Chris Statlander a couple of months later, they too can randomly turn face again and they can split away from him. But I've had expired moldy bread in my house that was not as stale as the Young Bucks are right now. They need to drop those titles ASAP. As I said earlier, build up the outrunners and let them be the ones to do it. By this point, I was ready for the main event. I'm like, all right, bring on Danielson and Moxley. And then I remembered, oh shit, we still had a Chris Jericho match. It was 11 p.m. and the Jericho match was only just beginning. I like Mark Briscoe and all, but that is just unacceptable. Unacceptable. Jim Ross joined for these last couple of matches. It wasn't even a bad match. It was good. I just couldn't bring myself to care about it. You know, Brian Keith got involved near the end behind the referee's back until Rocky Romero fought him off to the back. I thought I was watching Rampage. Jericho wanted a J-Driller of his own. He hit it. Briscoe, though, kicked out. And Mark fired up, hit a froggy bow, and then the J-Driller to retain his Ring of Honor World Championship. The story they told was that Jericho thought Jay Briscoe could have beaten him, but not Mark. You're not your brother. So Mark was out to prove him wrong and to basically tell Jericho to keep his brother's name out of his mouth. Yeah, we saw him get serious in a promo the other day on TV. That I liked. The match itself was fine. Putting it on this late, though, didn't do it any favors. The main event was Jon Moxley challenging Bryan Danielson for the AEW World Championship. I don't think it's a hot take to say that this was their greatest match together of all the matches they've had against one another. And I liked it even better than their Revolution match 2 years ago, the one where William Regal came out at the very end. You know, because they were going at it and he got between them and that was the birth of the BCC. That was a really good match, but I like this one better. And they bled buckets in that match. And outside of some incidental blood from Brian here, neither man cut themselves open. And look at that. They didn't even need it. Moxley jumped him before they even hit the chorus for Final Countdown, which is a total heel move. And they kept the music playing until the music was over. Tony Khan paid for it. He's going to make sure he gets full use of it if this is the last time he gets to use it for a while, because who the hell knows when we're going to see Bryan Danielson again. So Tony Khan made sure he was going to get his money's worth. So it was kind of like anarchy in the arena in a way, the first few minutes with the music playing while they brawled everywhere. Moxley gave him a pile driver on top of the announce desk. You knew they would make Danielson's neck the focal point of the match. It's been the focal point of every Bryan Danielson match, at least since Ospreay dropped him on his head with the Tiger Driver at Dynasty. Now, he's been selling injuries all year long, but the next stuff goes back at least that far. Marina Shafir was the only one out there with Mox. There was no Claudio, there was no Pac, there was no Wheeler Yuta. And she kept getting involved. She pulled up the mats outside to expose the concrete. Moxley tried for a pile driver, but Danielson backdropped him on the floor. It took most of the match before Bryce Remsburg finally had enough of Shafir's antics and ejected her. Bryan did a dive, Moxley caught him, and delivered a Death Rider on the concrete outside, then rolled him inside and covered him, but Bryan kicked out. Danielson hit a Busaiku knee, Moxley, though, kicked out. So Moxley hits another Death Rider, and this time Danielson kicks out at one, and the crowd explodes. So Bryan spat on him. Moxley grabbed him, hit a Gotch-style pile driver, and then sank in the rear naked choke. Danielson's fighting it, starting to fade, and he collapses backwards. Bryce checks the arm. He calls for the stoppage. And he awards the title to Jon Moxley, who is now the only four-time AEW world champion in history. The fans, I would say they were equally shocked and furious over the finish because they were not expecting it. And then they realized that that meant that not only did Bryan lose the belt, but his full-time career was over. And they were very upset. Danielson went down fighting. He never quit. My only issue that I had with it was as soon as the match ended, he immediately rolled to the corner, showing that he, in fact, was not unconscious anymore. Yeah, he should have laid there for a little bit longer before moving. Like, I know people go out and then they can wake back up quickly, you know, after the lights go out. But this was like too quick. This was like, you know, ding, ding, ding. And it's like, okay, let me roll over here now. It's like, hey, brother, just wait. Like, can't you wait like 10 seconds and then come to and then roll to the corner? But that aside, a minor nitpick, an excellent match with the expected title change. Fightful is reporting that Moxley was Danielson's handpicked opponent to end his full-time career. And if Tony Khan gave Bryan Danielson power over how he went out, it was really the most Bryan Danielson thing to do because not only did he lose at home, he chose to be murdered on his way out. I want you to put a plastic bag over my head. I want you to try to break my neck. All these things that followed here. Claudio, Pac, Marina Shafir, they all come out to the ring. And Moxley hands the AEW World title belt to Claudio to place inside of a black duffel bag. Like they were getting ready for like a big drug deal. There was no post-match feel-good goodbye speech for the live crowd, you know, nor will there be on Dynamite this week. We are not going to see Bryan Danielson for a very long time. He probably will be getting neck surgery soon. If he does, who knows how long he would be out for anyway. But he will be back for his revenge. I don't believe for a second that he is done or that he is even done with any of these men. But it's going to be a long time before we see him again in the ring. Darby Allin and Wheeler Yuta, they ran out to make the save before they could use another plastic bag on Danielson. But then Yuta hit a Busaiku knee to Darby, and the heels duct taped Darby's wrists to the middle rope, so he was trapped in the corner. All he could do was watch helplessly. He had no place to go. And Yuta had a conflicted look on his face, but then Moxley handed him the plastic bag, and it looked like Yuta said, "I'm sorry," before he did it, but he reluctantly suffocated Bryan with the plastic bag. At least this did not go on for an uncomfortable length of time, like when Moxley suffocated him. And I see people pointing out that, you know, while Yuta was hurt at the end of Dynamite, Bryan Danielson was busy doing Yes Chants and he was celebrating. And so that's why Wheeler Yuta attacked him. And that's all well and good if you also ignore the fact that it was Claudio who hit him 3 times in the gut with a hammer in the first place. Jeff Jarrett ran in. Oh boy. Jeff Jarrett. Now, to be fair, Jeff Jarrett has been on TV in the lead up to All In. He was the one who was going up to Bryan Danielson, trying to fire him up and kind of giving him a pep talk in the way that the Amazing Red did with Private Party. So it's not like Jarrett wanting to run in and come to Bryan's aid is completely out of left field, but still, I mean, come on. Jeff Jarrett runs in. It's almost midnight on the East Coast, and Jeff Jarrett is running out to make the save on this pay-per-view. Private Party ran out as well. They were all dispatched very quickly by Moxley and his crew. The absolute best part of this was Jim Ross on commentary. After Tony Schiavone screams, "Jeff Jarrett has arrived," he responds in the most sarcastic way imaginable. And maybe he didn't intend for it to come off like that, but it did. He just goes, "Not Jeff Jarrett." Like, I can visualize him rolling his eyes in the back of his head as he was saying it. Like, it just came off so condescending as they're trying to sell this heinous, serious beatdown angle. "Not Jeff Jarrett." Like, oh God, JR, man, even when he doesn't intend to, like, there's still some gems in there. There's still some gems in there from good old JR. But then Claudio placed a chair around Danielson's neck and he stomped on it. And that brought out the rest of the locker room. Orange Cassidy, Adam Cole, Daniel Garcia, Mark Briscoe, Hook, and the BCC bailed. And Jim Ross correctly asks the question, "Where the hell have you guys been?" Which is a totally valid question. They're in the back. They just watched this man get murdered in front of his friends and family. And they just stood around in the back until he got his neck broken, and then they had seen enough. So Cassidy helped security free Darby. They got a box cutter or whatever it was, razor blade, and they cut him free. They brought a stretcher out for Danielson, and Excalibur begins fake crying. Like, the somber voice is one thing. We get the somber voice for some of these angles sometimes in wrestling. But the fake crying, it was so bad. Like, you've got Excalibur, and he's like, you know, I it gets very low. Because I've been here all 5 years here in AW. What the fuck? Darby Allin, he's sitting outside up against the barricade, head in his hands, very upset over what had happened. Orange Cassidy was trying to console him, I guess. He was kind of just, like, huddled over him. And Garcia is standing there, and Hook is there. All AEW originals in this camera shot. I actually thought that closing camera shot, when they put the copyright on the screen, and you just saw Darby, and then there's Orange Cassidy, and there's Hook, and there's Garcia. Just given who was in that shot, I thought that was a very powerful shot, and I'm sure that was not, you know, done by accident that way, that those were the men that were in that camera shot. These are all AEW guys, through and through. It was a depressing way to go off the air, but that was the point. You know, it was a heavy angle to put over Moxley and his crew as the most sadistic heels imaginable. I like the angle. You don't always get a happy ending to these things. And they wanted a big angle to lead into Dynamite this week. A lot of people were probably expecting Shane McMahon and may have been left disappointed that they didn't get him. I was expecting him too, but I was not hoping for him. So I'm totally fine with him not being there. Although I'm sure he's coming in. I don't think they need him. But I'm sort of resigned to it at this point. And if he's coming in, I don't think we see it on Wednesday either. I think that's something they would say for a pay-per-view reveal. They've got Full Gear and World's End left on the calendar this year. As I said earlier, last year we got the Devil reveal at World's End. Adam Cole was the Devil for 2023. Maybe Shane will be their Devil for 2024. Them placing the belt in the bag like they were stealing it was interesting. I don't know what to make of that unless they're effectively stealing it to give to Shane or whoever the puppet master is behind all of this. It felt like they may be setting up Darby Allin to be the one to take the title from Jon Moxley. Moxley beat Darby a Grand Slam. Darby has said his goal is to be the AEW World Champion. Now, though, here the company is in peril, and this could be a way to give Darby his crowning moment by being the man to take the title back for AEW. Maybe a Grand Slam in Australia. It's coming up in February. But if he's hell-bent on climbing Mount Everest next year, which he is, you know, let's say he wins the title, that's going to be a really short run. You know, somebody brought this up in the Facebook group last night, and it's pretty wild. Danielson's last singles match on Monday Night Raw was a loss to Seth Rollins. His last singles match on SmackDown was a loss to Roman Reigns. And his last singles match, for now anyway, in an AEW ring, was a loss to Jon Moxley. The Shield owns Bryan Danielson's soul, then, now, and forever. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. You know, I'm on YouTube every week, multiple times a week, live streaming to thousands of people. And all you get to see is my face. You don't need to see any other parts of me, but that isn't true for everyone. Some people live stream themselves online even in their most intimate moments. Not me. There's no Solo Monster after dark. But if that's you, imagine going online without ExpressVPN and accidentally sharing some very private moments with the rest of the world. There isn't a rock big enough that you would be able to hide under. And forget the embarrassment of it. There's no telling what kind of implications something like that could have on your career, let alone your personal life. Use ExpressVPN and don't ever take that chance. Because all of your traffic flows through your internet service provider, they know every single website that you visit. And in the U.S., ISPs are legally allowed to sell that information to advertisers. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure, encrypted servers, so your ISP can't see your browsing history. And look, I mean, I'm having fun here, but It doesn't even have to be anything dirty. You know, people search for some weird things online. Maybe you just don't want total strangers to know what that is. What makes ExpressVPN the best VPN is how easy it is to use. You just fire up the app, you click one button, and you're protected. It also works on all of your devices, including phones, laptops, tablets, and smart TVs, and it hides your IP address, making it extremely difficult for third parties to track your online activity. Whenever I fly somewhere, as I did a couple of different times this year, even just last month on my trip to Chicago for House of Glory, I made sure that I had my ExpressVPN app loaded up on my phone because it gave me that peace of mind, knowing that I was protected. And that's important to me. I know that my activity and my data is safe and secure. I have enough on my mind to think about any given moment without having to think about that. Protect your online privacy today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. The Dynamite Go Home show aired on Tuesday opposite NXT on the CW, or opposite them for an hour anyway, since the show aired from 9 to 11 p.m. instead of the usual 8 to 10. Outside of a couple of good angles with Ospreay and the Callis family, and then there was another angle with the BCC and Bryan and Yuta at the end of the show. Outside of that, both of which, by the way, led to betrayals on the pay-per-view last night, on a show called Title Tuesday, they had one actual title match, and it involved a woman who had not even appeared on Dynamite since last November. Think of all the fucking titles in this company, and that is all they could muster for Title Tuesday. And it was their first time in that venue in Spokane. They were in Spokane, Washington. And it was sad to see Bryan Danielson out there wrestling what turned out to be quite possibly his last ever Dynamite match in front of such a small crowd. This company went from announcing a big 3-year media rights deal with Warner Brothers Discovery for a reported $555 million with streaming on Max and the whole nine yards to less than a week later drawing the lowest ratings in the history of Dynamite. Now, you have to put a little asterisk next to it because not only did the show air on a different day of the week, it aired on a different time too. And that's partially on Tony Khan for not doing a better job of promoting it. I thought they did a fucking terrible job the week before of driving home the change. So that didn't help. But that Title Tuesday show averaged 329,000 viewers. That is down from 680,000 the week before in their regular slot. And the lowest key demo number that the show has ever done as well. Now they're going to be back up in the usual range this week. Just because it's post-Wrestle Dream, they're not going to do 900 or a million or anything like that, but they should be back up in their normal range. But what makes it so much worse is that a year ago, when they went head-to-head with NXT, head-to-head for the full 2 hours, and like this year, not on their usual night, right? Title Tuesday, that show averaged 609,000 viewers. So from last year to this year, in the span of 12 months, their viewership dropped by nearly half. The NXT show on CW this week did 874,000 viewers, which was down slightly from the previous week. A year ago against Dynamite, when NXT was still on USA Network, the show averaged 921,000 viewers. So they actually did better on USA last year than they did on broadcast television this year, which I thought was interesting. Now, the only saving grace from AEW doing such a horrendous number is that the show wasn't very good. So it's a good thing a lot of people didn't watch. But what I find more concerning than any of the rating stuff are how terrible a lot of these gate advances are for their shows. Like, they are really struggling at the gate to sell tickets in a lot of these markets. They did well in Tacoma for WrestleDream last night. I think they had about 7,000 or 8,000 people in the building, but they did not do well in Spokane on Tuesday. And they have got a collision show coming up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa on October 26th. So we are less than 2 weeks away. And according to WrestleTix, they have sold less than 1,000 tickets. They have sold 798 tickets thus far for that show. Now, it's a venue that they are setting up for over 2,000, so it's not a huge venue, but 798 tickets. You know, Fightful reported this week that Jimmy Jacobs, he resigned from AEW this past week. He was a producer. He worked on the writing team for them, as he did previously for TNA and also in WWE. Of course, WWE shit-canned him after he took that picture outside the building with the Elite. That was the end of him. But according to Fightful, there's no hard feelings. He was just burned out. And AEW, they say, is looking at the change as a way to freshen up the writer's room, because they realize that they need to make changes creatively. And if that's true, if there's a recognition of that, that's the best news possible. Because it almost feels like they don't really acknowledge that, hey, you know, there's some holes here and there that need to be fixed. No, it's just, you know, this is the way we do things. We book for the sickos and it's where the best wrestle and blah, blah, blah. So if that's how they feel, I think that's great news. Now, Jimmy Jacobs, though, it's very important to point this out, was not holding Tony Khan back from making these creative changes beforehand. It's as if, well, this big weight has been lifted off of our shoulders and Jimmy Jacobs is gone. And so now we can make changes creatively. Like, he didn't have an anchor tied to his ass. At the end of the day, the buck stops with the man in charge. And these problems are not going to get solved until they make those creative changes and they can figure out a way to get people more invested in the product, because some of these numbers are getting very scary. You know, they got their guaranteed money from Warner Brothers Discovery, and that's great. And they may get their deal with Fox. We're still waiting on that. But that's a lot of content that they're going to have to produce. And the best barometer, I feel the best barometer still for whether or not that content is what people want to see, if it's hitting, if it's clicking, is how many of them you can get into the building. It may not be the number one way they make money anymore, like it used to be. Now it's all media rights and merch, and they have a lot of different ways they make money, TV being the biggest. But it is still the best indicator of how hot the product is, whether or not people are willing to spend their hard-earned money to actually buy a ticket when they come to town. And that continues to be an issue. And I think making changes creatively is the quickest and easiest way to try to solve that problem. No guarantee that it will, but I think that's where you got to start. It's not that they don't have any stars, we don't have any talent, we don't have any big names. Like, they have talent up the ass. They have big names on that roster up and down. Some of them are hurt right now, but they got plenty of talent. That's not the problem. The problem is, what are you doing with that talent? Where are they slotted? What programs and stories are they involved in? Are you giving people something that they want to pay money to come see? That is the issue that they need to address. And last week, I shared some pretty awful news about Killswitch. Luchasaurus, whatever you want to call him, Austin Mattelson. He collapsed at home at the end of last month. He was found by his fiance, rushed to the hospital. They diagnosed him with pneumonia in both lungs. His blood oxygen was down to 80, which is a terrible number. So they put him on oxygen, but it sounded like he was on the mend. The latest update is less rosy, and it comes from Brian Alvarez on Wrestling Observer Live. He said he's not back in the gym, and he will not be back in the gym for a while, and he's not going to be back wrestling probably for a while. He said that there were complications, and he may have a compromised immune system as well due to other factors, including possibly sleep apnea. He's also said to be at high risk for relapse. Said the big concern is that after all of this, they've been running test after test, and apparently there may be permanent damage. They found calcification in a heart valve, and his body is not producing iron. So he's got a whole bunch of tests that he apparently has to take. It's bad. It's bad enough that he is out of the hospital, but he still has to do oxygen. He still needs oxygen at home because even day-to-day activities can leave him out of breath, and he is not allowed to train since he's at high risk for relapse. He also cannot travel for at least 4 to 6 weeks and has to see a specialist as soon as he can get in. I don't want to say that it's a career-ending issue, but it could be a career-ending issue. So that's terrible. And I hear about the lungs and the blood oxygen and all that, but I hear the lungs, and I just can't help but think of Brody Lee and the issues that he went through. And I hear that, and it makes me think of what he went through. It was so sudden and unexpected, especially for someone his age. You know, if it's not addressed, it could be disastrous. And sometimes even if it is addressed, it could be disastrous. So You know, I don't like reading updates like this. It sounded like he was on the mend. Now it doesn't. I don't know what's going on, but I just hope he takes it easy and does what he needs to do. It's very scary stuff. Now, a few WWE news and notes here. Let's talk about The Rock for a minute. We saw The Rock at Bad Blood last weekend. He showed up. He had his People's Championship over his shoulder. He did the cutthroat sign, and it looked like they were planting the first seed for whatever is going to happen at WrestleMania next year. Otherwise, why the hell would this guy be back? But then we had an update from Dave Meltzer in the Wrestling Observer newsletter. And this is what Meltzer had to say about The Rock's status for WrestleMania in Las Vegas next year. He says, as of right now, Dwayne Johnson is not scheduled for the show. Obviously, that could change, and he's going to do what he wants all the time. While nobody can say it publicly, some with old school mentalities did not like the idea that he stole the show and it's not building to a match. Talking about Bad Blood last weekend. He's not going to be able to do Mania. He already gave word that he would not be able to do that match when he was asked about Rock against Roman Reigns against Cody Rhodes. The story is simply his schedule got too heavy and he could not commit to doing it right. Ultimately, it's October, and he would probably have until just before the Royal Rumble if he were to change his mind, and really, he probably could even change his mind after that, but it would throw everything into chaos as they have to have Mania plans when formatting the Rumble. Johnson's schedule has always been a factor because of the amount of preparation time he feels he needs to do in order to do what he wants to be able to do. It's why the original plan for him to face Roman at Mania in Los Angeles in 2023 did not happen after it had been talked about for years. Now, just on that point, I don't know where he's getting that from, because Rock has publicly stated that the reason that the match in 2023 in Hollywood did not take place is because they met to talk about it, and then they couldn't figure out a good enough idea, so they put their pencils down. So at least publicly, Rock never said, well, you know, I need to get myself into shape, and the way I need to get myself into shape, I don't have time. He made it sound like it was more of a creative issue. We just couldn't come up with the right idea for that Mania, so we put our pencils down and we just said, we'll come back to it. But now here, Meltzer is saying something different. Now, I talked about this on Friday briefly in the SmackDown review, because that's when the news dropped. And I said, look, it's Meltzer, so I know, I know, not the best track record this year. And so it may not be true, but if it is, and then I kind of talked about, well, if not, then that clears the way for a proper WrestleMania match then between Cody Rhodes and Randy Orton. So good. Because as I look at Mania, everything revolves around The Rock again, whether it's Rock and Roman, Rock and Cody, Rock, Roman and Cody. They got this great story they could tell with Cody and Randy and the history that they have together, but it just feels like they either can't do it now or they have to rush through it because we got to get to Cody and Rock, or Cody can't lose the title before he gets in the ring with Rock, and so that takes the drama out of Cody possibly losing the title between now and Mania, which I am all in favor of. I would do that. I would have Cody lose the title, and then he could chase to get it back, but you can't do that if they want the belt on him for a match with The Rock. So again, if Rock can't do the show, yeah, that's a huge star that they're losing on WrestleMania, this big show in Las Vegas next year, but great, you could do Cody and Randy. But I'm reading this and I'm thinking, I don't believe any of this shit. Like, it doesn't make sense for him to show up after so many months of being gone at Bad Blood. He's got the vest. He's the final boss. He's got the music. He's got the Brahma bull belt. He's looking at Roman. He's looking at Cody. This was a sign that something is coming. It's not a sign of, hey, I just want to remind you people that I'm alive. And yeah, I'm not going to be at WrestleMania. Because if Rock is too busy to do Mania, or he doesn't feel like he can get a long enough training camp to get in shape for Mania, his training camp, he had a full training camp like a real fucking fighter this year. It was weeks and weeks and weeks. He vlogged it. Like, it takes time. If he can't find the time to do a training camp to be at Mania, he's not working a match at the Royal Rumble. He's not working a match at Elimination Chamber. He's not working War Games at Survivor Series, okay? It's either Mania or bust. Then why was he on the show last weekend? It doesn't make any sense. So a fan asked Rock about this on Instagram and said, are you really not working Mania 41? Say it ain't so. And The Rock responded to this person and said, don't believe any of that bullshit. So there you go. It doesn't make sense because it's bullshit, according to The Rock. Now, Meltzer did have an update. Apparently, this is from Wrestling Observer Radio last night. He said, I know he was not confirmed for the show as of Thursday, so if something changed, I'll find out. If he wants to do it, he's doing it. It's up to him, obviously. As long as it's confirmed by when it needs to be confirmed, it can be confirmed at any time. They want to know going into the Royal Rumble where they are going, and at that point, we'll see. But yeah, that's the deal. That's very different than what he said the other day, though. Of course, it's October. They may not have their media plans locked in yet. Royal Rumble is still a few months away. Royal Rumble is not until the 1st of February. So I'm not shocked if Rock has not yet confirmed what his status is going to be. But that's very different than saying that Rock went to them and said, I can't do it. I'm busy. I have a scheduling issue. I have a movie to shoot. This seems like two different conflicting reports from the same fucking person. Maybe Dave's got multiple personalities, and one personality is reporting one thing, and the other personality is reporting another. Maybe he has a newsletter personality, and he has a radio personality. And they seem to be in conflict with each other. Dave number one and Dave number two. Rock will be at WrestleMania. I don't buy into this shit at all. This is going to be a big show in Vegas next year. There's no way that Rock is not going to be on that WrestleMania show in some form or fashion, probably in the ring, but in some form or fashion. I don't buy for a second that he came back last weekend and he's not going to be at WrestleMania next year. Gunther defeated Sami Zayn on Raw Monday night to retain the World Heavyweight Championship. And there's been talk about Bill Goldberg and are they going to do something with Bill Goldberg because he made that appearance at Bad Blood. And Triple H posted a video from backstage after the show on social media of him embracing Goldberg and saying, we'll talk again, you know, very soon. And again, Meltzer and the Observer is talking about how, well, there's nothing scheduled for Survivor Series and there's nothing scheduled for WrestleMania. But the Mania card doesn't have to be finalized yet, so maybe they'll do Gunther and Goldberg on that show. I actually think there is smoke to the fire on doing a match with those two, and I would not do it at WrestleMania. If you're going to do it, the place that I think would be appropriate for it, you want to use Goldberg. You want to get a big match out of Goldberg. Try to, you know, utilize whatever value you still think he may have to the audience. You've got a big show coming up in December called Saturday Night's Main Event. And they're going to treat this show like a PLE because they have no PLE anyway in December. They have no PLE in December or January. So they're going to treat this show like a big deal, as they should, because it's their first live network primetime special on NBC in many, many, many years. You want to do Gunther and Goldberg, possibly for the World Heavyweight Championship, even though I have no desire to see Goldberg wrestling for a world title again, do it on that show. That would be a big match for Saturday night's main event. Gunther and Goldberg on NBC in December. If you are going to do it there. I have no interest in seeing that built up as a WrestleMania match. Of all the people that you could put in the ring with Gunther at WrestleMania, Goldberg is not the one that should be in the ring with him. Raw Monday Night also was the first two-hour show that they've done in many years. They've gone back to 2 hours through the end of the year until they premiere on Netflix. It was not a good show. And what they were doing was they were booking a two-hour show with 3 hours worth of talent. And it's going to take a little bit, it seems, for them to acclimate to that because they do have more people on that roster because that's just the way the draft went. When they drafted people to Raw, that was in May. And at the time, Raw was still a three-hour show. For these next couple of months, it's not. So there's going to have to be an adjustment period here. Now, they taped this Monday's show. Tomorrow night's show is already in the can because they're traveling over to Europe. They have a European tour. I think a UK tour. So the show is already taped. And I don't know who's on the show. I didn't look at the format, the matches, or anything like that. So it may be more of the same. I think that we could better judge Raw starting next week when they're back live as far as how these shows are going to look and feel. And there were a couple of really good matches on the show. Gunther and Sami Zayn was very good. Sheamus and Pete Dunne had a Donnybrook match that I thought was very enjoyable. And then you had the rest of the show where it just felt like, all right, we're going to try to get as many people on as we can. We're going to have an intercontinental title match with Jey Uso that's going to go 4 minutes, even though we promoted it all week. I mean, that's just, it's just ridiculous. And the women's match was the worst of them all because they took 10 women and they put them in a match together, 10-woman tag team match. And there was said to be talk internally after the show, people who weren't happy with how that segment came off. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the women in that match were not very happy about being shoved together that way and rushed through a 10-person tag, because nobody gets over when you do a match like that. Now, it's different if you're going to have a 10-person tag with people who are actually over. And I'm sorry, but the women in that match, you know, there's just nobody right now who I would say are, you know, is truly over to where the audience was super into them or chanting for them. I can't say there's any combination of the women that were in that match, whether you can put together whatever singles or tag team match you want. There is no interesting combination of any of the women that were in that match right now. There just isn't. Pure Fusion Collective? I mean, please. What is there to get excited about? And they're trying to find a spot for all of them on the show. That's great. That doesn't mean that every idea they come up with is going to be a winner. It's not. And shoving 10 women in one match is not going to suddenly get people to care about them. But they wanted to try to get them all on the show. And it's okay if they're not all on the show every single week. They could be on the show next week. Use half the number of women that you used. And the other half you can use next week. When you shove them all in one match like that, I don't see what that accomplishes, especially when it feels like you're just rushing through it. So hopefully tomorrow night will be a little bit better. SmackDown was a better show, certainly in terms of the key stories, more interesting than Raw was on Monday night. We had Roman Reigns and Jimmy Uso, and it's very clear they're getting the band back together because they realize that they are outnumbered by the members of Solo Sikoa's bloodline. They were left laying at the end of the show. Jimmy had told Roman at the beginning, you know, we need help. And he didn't say his name, but he did say that, or he implied, that he is going to look to his brother. He's going to look to Jey Uso. And Roman said, no yeet. So Roman Reigns is not on board with that idea. Jey Uso should also not be on board with that idea. And that's where things get interesting with these segments, because you got Jimmy Uso in the middle as peacemaker, trying to make amends with these men to get them on the same side in time to do a War Games match at Survivor Series. But you got to take your time with this. Jey shouldn't want to just do them a favor. Why would he want to do them a favor? It's because they're family? Look at the shit that he had to go through. He's in a good spot now. He's the Intercontinental Champion. He's selling merch. He's one of the most popular stars in the entire company. And he is completely divorced from his family. He got over without them. Now he's going to be like, okay, yeah, sure, I'll do you this favor. I have no problem with Solo and Jacob Fatu and the Tongans, but okay, sure, yeah, I'll help you guys out. No, you've got to tell that story, and you've got to make sure you just push all that tension out into the forefront until finally, you know, probably a few weeks before Survivor Series, Jey will have a change of heart. But Jey Uso and Sami Zayn joining with Roman and Jimmy is probably the play for War Games against Solo and his crew. So they started the story in that direction on Friday night. Kevin Owens also attacked Cody Rhodes off camera after Bad Blood outside of his bus in the parking lot. They didn't even show the footage on TV this week on SmackDown. They're taking a very different approach with this angle where they really don't want people even knowing about it. They said it's an internal matter. It'll be handled internally. They didn't replay it. They barely even mentioned it. Owens was fined and suspended. He came out. He crashed the show even though he wasn't supposed to be there. Ended up with Cody Rhodes coming out after him. Randy Orton came out, tried to, you know, again, play peacemaker, just like Jimmy is trying to do with the bloodline. And he ended up getting shoved and he punched Kevin Owens in the face. And then he told Cody after Randy did, look, you get on your bus. I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to talk to Kev, try to sort all this out. And then we saw later in the show that Kevin Owens was kicking Randy Orton's ass outside in the parking lot. And I saw earlier today, actually, they put out video of what was supposed to be security camera footage. I don't think there's any audio,
But it's just the, kind of like an overhead shot of what happened where Owens attacked Randy Orton out in the parking lot. So now Orton has been roped into this, and he too has been assaulted by Kevin Owens. See, this is interesting. This is taking this story in an interesting direction now. When will Randy Orton end up turning against Cody Rhodes? Is he going to align with Kevin Owens, or are they going to continue to be at odds as well? This feels to me like they're setting up for a triple threat match at Survivor Series for the championship. You get all three men in the match because you almost have to. If you don't do it that way and you just do Owens and Cody, Orton still has to be involved in some way. He's got nothing else to do on that show. This is Mr. Survivor Series here. You got to get him on that show. You know, maybe he can be the referee, just like Rollins was for the CM Punk and Drew McIntyre match at SummerSlam. Or you get him involved and make it a triple threat. That seems to be the direction there. And as I've said, a lot of this depends on what Rock is going to do or not do at WrestleMania. I still believe he'll be on the WrestleMania card. Maybe they're not sure of that right now. If it were me, boy, it would be awfully tempting to shoot a big angle and take that title off of Cody Rhodes, either at Survivor Series or Saturday night's main event, and make him fight to get it back instead of just keeping it on him. Shake things up a little bit, make it a little more interesting. But I like that story. That to me was the highlight of the show on Friday, were all of the segments that were involving Orton and Owens and Cody as they pushed that along. They also made it very clear without naming them that the Motor City Machine Guns are making their debut on SmackDown this Friday against Los Garza. Nick Aldis is bringing in a brand new tag team. And we got one more vignette, you know, with the car and the sirens and everything. And in this one, you saw the initials MCMG, which means they're keeping their name. I wasn't too sure about that, so that's great. So they will be on SmackDown this Friday night. That'll be their big main roster debut. I'm happy for them. And I'm happy for that tag team division, too, because they could use a team like the Machine Guns right now. One thing that was not good, they had a women's tag team title match on SmackDown that barely cracked 2 minutes, with Bianca Belair and Jade Cargill defending the titles against Lash Legend and Jakara Jackson from NXT. They set this up in a segment on Tuesday night on the CW. If the goal here, clearly it wasn't. If it was, boy, did they fuck this up. But if the goal here was to try to get Jackson and Legend over to an audience that might not be familiar with them if they don't watch NXT, boy, did they fail. So these two women come out, they're making their debut entrance for the match, and the first thing that happens is they get interrupted by Kevin Owens, who is suspended and not supposed to be there, and in the middle of their entrance, Kevin Owens comes through the crowd, gets into the ring, he apologizes, and everything just immediately turns to that angle, which, to be fair, is far more interesting than anything these four women were going to do on this show. But even still, right? Talk about a jobber entrance, right? So that was strike number one. Then during the tag team title match, the focus of the match, by and large, was not on Jakara Jackson and Lash Legend. It wasn't even on Bianca and Jade. It was on Chelsea Green, who smelled after being thrown in a dumpster last week in her match with Meechin. And that's all they were talking about. Michael Cole on commentary. He's like, you know, he's gagging. He's dry heaving. He can't stand the stench. Lash Legend at one point booted Chelsea over the announce desk, so that might be setting up for a tag match with Chelsea and Piper against Lash and Jakara maybe on Tuesday. But so the focus was on her. That's strike number two. Strike number three was the fact that the match went barely 2 minutes, and then they got beat. So tell me, what did that do for Lash Legend and Jakara Jackson? Nothing. It did absolutely nothing for them. I think the only goal of this may well have been to set up a random match here with Chelsea Green and Piper Niven against these two. Again, maybe on NXT this week or SmackDown this Friday. That may have been the only point in doing what they did here, but regardless, this was fucking terrible. I expect a lot better on Monday, when they have the tag team title match with Bianca and Jade defending against Damage Control. I'm assuming, and again, I haven't looked at any of the spoilers, I'm just assuming that we don't get a title change, because it would be weird if they did a title change at the tapings on Monday and then sent Bianca and Jade out there as the defending champions on Friday because the match hasn't aired yet. I mean, this is like old school, like WCW used to do that shit where you would have a title change, but they would still take the former champion and have them continuing to defend their title on live events because it wouldn't air on TV for like another 2 or 3 months. You know, and I get it, but like it's still fucking weird. And it's not like some fans back then didn't have access to the dirt sheets where it's like, wait a minute, what's going on here? So yes, I am assuming we are not going to get a title change tomorrow night, but we should get a really good match between Damage Control and Bianca and Jade, provided they get more than 2 fucking minutes like they gave these women. Nobody gets over in 2 minutes. NXT on the CW. This was week 2. I did a review of the show because I did a dual review on YouTube on Tuesday for this and for Dynamite, so that was the second week in a row you got an NXT review out of me. I thought it was a much better show than week 1. I mean, it was so much more enjoyable than that first show. Part of it was where they were. I love that venue. They were at the Factory in St. Louis, which is an intimate venue. They had booked a larger arena. They couldn't sell tickets, so they downgraded. It was the best thing that could have happened to them because I think it made for a really fun atmosphere. I just liked the look visually of the show. And I said, it reminded me of that Lowell Auditorium or Lowell Civic Center, whatever it is in Lowell, Massachusetts. They ran that venue twice in 1997 for Raw. It has a very distinct look to it with like a balcony and everything. I like stuff like that. We had Stephanie Vaquer. She showed up for the first time in person to stand with Julia as they set up a program with Julia and Stephanie gunning for Roxanne Perez and for Cora Jade. So there should be a tag team match coming up soon, maybe at Halloween Havoc. Tony D'Angelo. This was probably the big story on the show right here. Tony D'Angelo beat Oba Femi, the longest reigning North American champion and most dominant in NXT history, is no longer the champion. He has been beaten. And they've been building this story now for a little while. They did a good job with it. And that's why they were rewarded with the crowd reaction that they were. The fans were delighted to see Tony D go over, and he's celebrating after. He's draped in the Italian flag. They copied the Rocky III story arc. That's what they've been doing over the last month with the backstage segments and just the whole story, you know, of Tony just trying to finally win the big one here. And he did. And I thought they had a really good match. It was the best match on the entire show. It was better than their match at No Mercy last month. Oba, I don't think he's going anywhere just yet. I think they're going to keep him down there for a while longer. They do have a draft coming up next year, probably in May. And I could see him being drafted to the main roster. I could see him having a cameo in the Royal Rumble match in February. But this guy, again, I've been putting him over because he's got all the tools. He can work. He can talk. He looks like a monster. Doesn't wrestle like one. And I mean that in a good way. I don't mean he doesn't wrestle like a monster. What I mean is he doesn't wrestle like some of the monsters that you've probably seen before who don't exactly have a very dynamic, kind of in-ring style or in-ring arsenal, shall we say. You know, his work is great. And it's not like he's out there lumbering around in the ring, just kind of throwing his weight around. The guy can work. So I think he's going to do very well. Tony D'Angelo is another one. Both these guys, they're products of the developmental system. You know, when you see these two guys out there, they are a credit to that system because they did not come from the indies. Like so many guys who came through and in the black and gold days, it was really built on guys who were experienced, who could come in and not only go on TV and work against each other, but, you know, work with some of the younger guys who were on their way up. And they still do that just in a different way. I mean, they have a lot of people from the main roster who will make appearances on NXT. Every now and then somebody will spend time in NXT like Baron Corbin did for a long time in Apollo Crews, where they get to work with the younger, less experienced talent. But the talent like Oba and Tony D, they didn't work in GCW. They didn't work in PWG. They didn't work in Ring of Honor or CZW. They were plucked from other sports. Tony D was a collegiate wrestler. Oba Femi was a shot put champion. These guys came in and it was like a project. Like, okay, what can we do with these guys? We got to build these guys up from the ground up. And you see now it's paying dividends because these guys are ready for the main roster today if they want to call them up. I do think Tony D has a ceiling with that gimmick. I don't think he's going to be able to do that gimmick for the rest of his career unless he wants to be mid-card. But he's really good, and Oba is great. So I really enjoyed that. We had Axiom and Nathan Fraser. They beat Austin Theory and Grayson Waller to retain the NXT Tag Team titles. And then Randy Orton in the main event in his hometown of St. Louis beat Javon Evans, the 20-year-old prodigy of the year in NXT. And they built to a finish that was to be Javon Evans doing a corkscrew dive off the top rope right into an RKO from Randy Orton. And unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. He over-rotated. He hit the mat before Randy did. So Randy, you know, calmly got up and picked him up, and then he hit him with a proper RKO. Not what the Randy Orton of old would have done, but it's what the Randy Orton of today does. And you could just tell how dejected Evans was and how upset he was. And he's like, I'm sorry. He blamed himself, you know, because he fucked up the move. He put it on himself. And Randy Orton was like, don't worry about it. You're the man. And he raised his hand, and I'm sure he put a good word in for him when he got to the back. Because shit happens. That's why I joked the other day when there were reports from Fightful about how there's no heat on Javon Evans. Like, why would there be heat on Javon Evans? What did he do wrong? He missed a move? Why would there be heat on him? Did he flip his shit when the match was over and start throwing furniture like Brett in Montreal, throwing monitors and crap? Like, no. It happens. He's going to be fine. And one day, a few years down the road, they may get to run it back again. Only this time they could run it back on Raw. They could run it back on SmackDown. Right? Randy's not going anywhere. He just signed a new long-term contract. Javon Evans, if he stays healthy, could have 20 more years, 20 plus more years ahead of him. I thought they had a very good match in spite of the botch finish. There was an incident, though, at the hotel after the show where the NXT talent were staying. This comes per Mike Johnson on PW Insider. He says, we are told that a male fan was allegedly caught trying to take photos of the feet of female talent as they made their way through the hotel, and he was ejected not once, but twice. How much of a degenerate loser must you be to get ejected once and then think, you know what? I'm going to go back inside and do it again. And then get ejected a second time. And what is Quentin Tarantino doing in St. Louis anyway? I thought he lived in Tel Aviv these days. What the hell's he doing at a hotel in St. Louis? One last note here. Jesse Ventura has talked recently about doing business again with WWE and being on the verge of signing a Legends contract. Well, he is officially back in the fold. Nearly 6 months after revealing that he was in negotiations with the company, he announced on Thursday in a video that he has signed a WWE Legends contract. And he called it a full circle moment. He said, I thought it was time that maybe I tell everybody, indeed, hell has frozen over. I am back in the WWE as a legend. I've gone through negotiations, we've reached agreements, and I feel very good about it. You know, I'm 73 years old now, and my life has now gone full circle. I got my first fame and fortune in the wrestling industry. I went on to do many, many other things above and beyond wrestling. And now maybe it's only right that I come back to wrestling in the twilight of my life and finish off with what I always was, a pro wrestler. I'll just say this. There's even bigger and better stuff waiting to happen. Let's remember one thing. I never did get my shot at Hogan, did I? Oh no. I don't even want a tease of anything like that. Jesse don't need Hogan. Jesse did just fine on his own without Hogan or riding Hogan's coattails. I'm glad that Jesse is back in business with WWE because it gives me hope that maybe in like the next video game or something they can get his voice in there. Like, he may not want to do, you know, commentary now on TV, and I doubt he's even familiar with the product. I mean, is he sitting there watching fucking SmackDown every week as the Bloodline story plays out? Give me a break. What do you think? He showed up at the arena a few weeks ago and went, holy shit, it's Bianca Belair. I'm a huge fan. Like, give me a break. So I'm sure he's not up to speed on the stories and stuff, but I would love it if they can get his voice in that freaking game. I don't know if it's too late, right? The game usually comes out in what, March? What do you think? 2K25, you get Jesse Ventura back on commentary in the game. That'd be great. But even just doing other projects with him, maybe he can host, you know, specials of some kind, you know, like throw it to classic matches on Peacock or something. Yeah. I mean, there's any number of things that they could do with him, even if he's not going to be actively on television every week. He still has that voice. You know, he's 73 years old. He's older now, but he still sounds the same. He's got that booming voice. I'm sure they could find stuff to do with him. If you have questions for me, you know how to reach me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. We're not going to do a mailbag this week, but I am collecting many questions. I've got many emails over the last couple of weeks, so I'm going to play catch up here at some point. I'm actually in the middle of going through the questions that you guys submitted to me on YouTube. If you are a channel member, there was a post that I put up about a week ago, and I told you guys to post one question in the thread, and it just cracked 100 as I gulped as I saw that. So I'm going to start going through them this week. I think what I might do is I might just do a series of videos. I'll just, like, I haven't even looked at the questions yet. I'll just start literally bring up the thread, and I'll just sit here and go through X number of questions. And when we hit a certain point, I'll stop, do another video. I mean, with the questions there, I could probably get 3 or 4 videos out of it. So that is for channel members only. That is going to be a members only exclusive. You have to be a channel member on YouTube. So if you are interested in that, I mean, the thread is still open. If you go under the community tab, and you could submit a question there and just keep an eye out. I'm hoping the first video goes up this week. I'm going to try to record something tomorrow. It's the least I could do. We picked up a whole bunch of channel members. We have a whole bunch of members who have been with me now for 30 months, 40 months of membership. It's amazing. So keep an eye out for that. Follow me on Twitter @Solemonster. And of course, always make sure your notifications are turned on the YouTube channel if you are a subscriber there. We are very close. We are, I want to say last I checked, maybe 60 or so subscribers away from 82,000. Maybe you can help get me there this week on YouTube. I will be back here with you next Sunday for episode 884. Of the Sound Off. And so until then, I wish you all a very good week. Be well, stay safe, and we'll do it all over again for 884 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
He congratulated Andrade, saying that he talked to Nick Aldis, and Andrade is the next contestant challenge for the United States Championship. So he hopes Andrade is feeling the tingles and the jingles. Are you feeling the tingles and the jingles watching this stream? I hope you are. That's what I want. When I come on here live, I want you to feel the tingles and the jingles. I hope you're feeling tingles in parts of your body that have not even been active and worked for years.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solemonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solemonster.
I love you, Solo.